Welcome back, everybody, to our last session.
Hoorah! So, we did have
that
too. No, I don't know, I just want to be German about
it. I should be sad, like it's all. No more books of friends. So, we're on to our last panel, which has again its placeholder title, Kinship and Belonging. We're going to be discussing books like Eva, Asama, and Julie. I don't know whether your book has your book appeared as a material thing yet?
Yes, it has.
So, like, talk about being, you know, ahead of the curve. Yeah, and our discussants are going to be David, Julio, and Judith. So, to you guys.
So do I start with Eva's book then?
Yeah, the summary. Of,
right.
Yeah, okay. We decided we'll separate the summaries from our comments. See how that works. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm gonna summarize. I'll try and summarize Eva's book, which is a linguistic, I would say, linguistic ethnography of oral traditions in Kazakhstan. She's looking at poetry performances. Blessings in everyday life, but also in other kinds of circumstances like pilgrimages, storytelling about miracles and dreams. So through a very, I would say, poetic description and analysis of these various oral traditions, she in her work traces the emergence of an ancestral worldview and its renewed meanings and usages in the post-Soviet context, which is marked by economic uncertainty, censorship, and cultural nationalism. So she starts with the blessings that are also called bata. Do I pronounce it?
Bata.
Okay. which she describes as a form of education on how to become a proper cultural person. These blessings are performed in various circumstances, sometimes at life cycle events, as a means to prepare a young person to a new beginning. So they function as, they have this performative capacity to provide reassurance in times of distress. And in fact, she explained that they provide, you know, the performance of these blessings in these various occasions provide the framework for the reinforcement of a moral community from the very, you know, individual to the, you know, broader community. Then she looks at, you know, storytellings during pilgrimages, and she explained that they open space of possibility for conversation about dreams, care, faith, purity, and a possibility of dialogue between the deceased and the living. And she described that as a kind of spiritual geography. And finally, so the poetry performances, also called aitis, yeah, offer the possibility to provide a veiled political commentary, which is made possible by the collaboration between the poet and his sponsor. So through these three discursive tradition, which reenacts forms of ancestral leadership and care, actors are able to provide or to revive a model of inclusive leadership, which is in contrast with the kind of political power that they face in the current moment. And this political commentary is both meaningful, but is also legitimate and acceptable because it carries this legitimacy of tradition. Therefore, she argues, dialogue with ancestors allows people to step outside hierarchy of state power and into the moral space of historical and cultural legitimation. So this book is a is an exploration of the condition of possibility of political critique in a context of extremely reduced political freedom. That's something also that I explore in my book through the lens of gender performances. And that Aksana also discussed by looking at the politics of patronage in Kyrgyzstan. I think this book brings important nuances to mainstream depiction of post-Soviet polities, which tend to portray, you know, these countries as ravaged by corruption and nepotism, and which with the impression that actually there is no space for political expression. She builds on Bakhtin, and of course I was kind of excited to see that I'm not the only one, on Bakhtin and his work on the dialogic imagination to highlight the social and plural nature of voice and the world-making potential of language. Just something that I really liked here. Perhaps I just can quote directly from her because she says that much better than me. So, referring to these poetry performances, she says, to win one of these poetry competition, to win an 80s is to leave one's opponent without a way to respond without words. Poets themselves draw a distinction between their words or phrases and the concept of having a voice. And later on she says, there is no question for poets that their words are dialogic, but in the course of performance they are not single authors, where author is defined as someone who has selected the sentiment that are being expressed and the words in which they are encoded. At a basic level, 80s literally means shared talks. And all poets know that the success of any given performance depends on their dialogue with an opponent. Yeah, so it's the construction of a commentary that is not, articulated through a dialogue between between the poets. And there, the ancestors serve as a dialogic trope for serving and unifying community and the broader nation. So I think it's a very elegantly written book with very important idea for, you know, alternative ways of finding the political in the everyday. And I think it's very a very beautiful contribution to the literature on the region. Yeah. I leave it there for the moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Do I just go in the order?
Yeah, I can do that. So I'll continue with briefly summarizing Aksana Ismailbekova's book, Blood Ties and the Native Son, Poetics of Patronage in Kyrgyzstan. Aksana's book, which is based on 14 months of fieldwork in northern Kyrgyzstan, explores the rise and fall and eventual death of a patron she calls Rahim and his relations with the people she calls his clients, including kin. She's interested how this particular relationship shaped the economic and social life of the whole region. In a political climate in which a dozen of influential businessmen turned politicians had been killed in Kyrgyzstan during the time of her fieldwork, she concentrates on the different strategies of this one person, culminating in his success to enter the parliamentary electoral campaign and winning a seat in parliament. Patronage networks, as Aksana shows, are widespread across Kyrgyzstan, linking local village life with national politics and economic developments. She also shows that this happens through kinship, as kinship and patronage are overlapping categories. Kinship relations are manipulated to legitimate patronage, and it is through the Kyrgyz segmentary system that kinship can become the foundation of these networks, she argues. This is why she sees no contradiction between kinship and patronage developing alongside democracy and modernization. They are rather the primary mechanism through which liberal democracy has become embedded in local cultural and social practices in the very place of socialism, she argues. In her individual chapters, she first situates her work in a very classical body of literature, which I very much liked, ranging from Evans Pritchard to New Institutional Economics to Michael Hertzfeld's Social Poetics. She gives us a sense of the place where she conducted fieldwork, while keeping actual places and often names anonymous. She then impressively introduces the way Kyrgyz kinship works and has genealogies throughout the book to illustrate the manifold connections between actors. Focusing then on a particular form of kolkhoz, she explains the interactional and codependent nature of patron-client relationships that we know from anthropological literature on the Mediterranean, but which has, to my mind, never been thoroughly introduced into the Central Asian context up to date, despite a lot of writings on clan politics in Central Asia. The final chapters are devoted to analyzing how rahim enters the political realm and how kinship and patronage form the backbone of electoral democracy in Kyrgyzstan. She writes, I quote, "From a local perspective, corruption in politics is unavoidable, but real democracy can nevertheless exist if and when people have the opportunity to voice their collective political claims. It is necessary to ask," she says, how regional or kinship loyalties are hypostatized by the fact of electoral politics. How are they turned from a relative, fluid, and situational aspect of village life into a dramatic line of demarcation?" And I think Aksana's book does a very good job in answering that question.
So I'm looking both my left and right, and they have so much neater notes than I have. I want to begin actually by disagreeing with Julie on something she said earlier. Don't worry, it's not a real disagreement. Because she was talking about in the last session how she didn't feel she was very good with titles. And I actually think that the title is really good for the book. I think in some ways, From Belonging to Belief is a slightly unusual construction. It sounds easier to say From Belief to Belonging. But Belonging to Belief is what her book is about. So I actually think it's a great title. I don't think you're bad at this, like you say. I think it's a great book, and I'll talk more about it when we sort of give a general overview of our own readings of the three books collectively. But she's engaging with debates in secularism and how religion gets constructed. And she's using Kyrgyzstan to do that, and she does it in very productive ways. She's looking at she's arguing that modern definitions of secularism and modern definitions of religion often exist within a liberal secular variant, right? So we're predetermined to think that it exists on liberal terms. Again, I agree with what she says. She says within that is this notion of an interiorized self, or that one has to sort of engage with individual beliefs. And she's arguing that actually there's also other forms of secularism we need to consider, like in the Soviet Union being one of a non-liberal form of secularism. She is talking about the way in which you have a move from sort of this contained notion of Muslimness as a collective of ethno-religious belonging to sort of this new discourse of Muslim being a category of belief, right? And what's wonderful about it is how she situates the narrative ethnographically in Bazar Kogan, and she shows the way in which people are struggling with this transition, right? And she's arguing that some of the unease that people feel, sort of in this particular time that she's talking about in the 2000s, mid 2000s or so, is sort of as they're trying to engage with what these new categories mean, as they're moving from sort of being Muslim, sort of a general identity category, sort of having to internalize it in how people go about doing it. Like I said, the whole book is situated in a broader argument in anthropology of Islam and anthropology of religion more broadly. But the specific case gives us a sense of the process. She's going through the chapters, she talks about the way in which people become Muslims in Bazar Kargan, and how it's, you know, how it is a public form of Islam, that there's reactions and cooperations with different actors, that it's through this very dynamic back and forth exchange. She gives narratives of how people go to weddings to hear preachings and engage with this new information and come to terms with how they might, you know, incorporate this into their lives, what it means, make their own, take their own spin on it. She shows how the way in which religion is taught and guided by people who were trained in the Soviet period, right? Who were trained in this earlier framework. And it's not just people coming from the outside, but there's sort of a mixture of sort of people with sort of more classically Soviet ideas of Islam, engaging with people who are learning bits and pieces from elsewhere. She talks about how people are struggling veiling, how, you know, decisions as to veil, what all of these things mean, how one does it, the construction of mosques, as well as different ways, whether, you know, one of the extended examples is how the Brazilian soap opera Clone, sort of gets, you know, shows people engaging with religion in different ways, right? Sort of trying to make it their own. And what we see throughout is sort of the struggle of the process of these categories of Muslimness and religion, and that it's not always an easy process experience to go through as the practitioner figuring out what it means, but it also shows the way in which because modernity also plays into her discussions, is that Julie argues that we often are perhaps too forward-looking in how we conceive or conceptualize modernity, sort of as this sort of line of progression. That you know, as people are engaging with tradition and interpreting what it means, they're doing it in a modern frame, and that perhaps we also need to sort of complicate our understandings of modernity to include the way in which people co-opt tradition themselves. So I think it's a great book.
So should we just now just start ask some questions? And so perhaps I should start with Eva and Axena's books, because I think they are touching upon similar issues. Both of you are trying to describe, I mean, in Axena's case, you're trying to describe how patronage borrows cultural forms of kinship lineage to ensure a locally legitimate form of democracy. You know, you're trying to show how actually these forms of patronage are building on local notions and understanding of kinship, notably this important figure of the native son that this character you follow, Haim, embodies, and how it's in fact a means for people to access to certain, relying on this character of native son is a means for people to voice their demands at a broader national level. Whereas Eva, she's also interested in the ways in which people are able to voice a critique from below using, you know, the moral universe of the ancestor and these various oral traditions and so on and so forth. And I was kind of very interested in that, and I was wondering the extent to which these practices could be understood as copying strategies in a context where there is limited room for political expression, if it's simply a kind of coping strategy, even though I don't really like this expression, or if they have a stronger subversive power. And what are the possibilities and the limitations of these expressive forms. And I'm asking that to you as much as I'm asking that to myself, because that's also a question that I was often asked, you know, okay, this is all well, and you are showing that actually there are ways for women to find a political voice, but at the same time, what is the potential for that, of that, you know? Is there something we can see in this practice that can give us hope for them to actually achieve something in the political arena more broadly? So that's my question for the two of you. As for Julie, I thought it was really interesting to, I mean, I really loved the chapter about the weddings and the six speakers coming to, you know, to give their own guidance, religious guidance, and the fact that it attracted many young people who would come to just listen to what was said and experiment with, well, even with their dress, with segregation, with all that. And I thought it was very refreshing the way you framed these practices, because I think it's it brings much nuance to the anthropology of Islam that is dominating the field today, notably the work of Saba Mahmoud and Hirschkind and so on and so forth, even though I think it's also very important work. But so in a way, I mean, the practices you describe, especially the ones of these young people, could be interpreted as a new form of orthodoxy, or they are perceived from the outside, from the older generation, as a, you know, as potentially threatening, because they put the emphasis on belief, and therefore they do not follow the framework of secularism as it was defined by under the Soviet period. Yet you show how these young people navigate this new field with both distance and curiosity, and also a lot of self-reflection on what they're doing. And you place these developments in a broader frame of view, taking into account, you know, the emergence of capitalist market economies, nation-state secularism, and discourses on Islamic extremism. So, I mean, I wanted to ask you, and also because it's my own interest, but how you, I mean, you don't seem to really adhere to this idea of Islamic revival being mostly about ethical self-fashioning. I mean, you seem to bring, you know, other elements, and I just wanted to, you to discuss a bit more about your relationship with this more American kind of scholarship. Yeah, maybe I just leave it there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I guess there's two ways of engaging with the books, and I'm not sure if I did the assignment correctly, but one is I think when you're reviewing a book, you review it on the terms that the author wrote it, what they said they were going to do, and what they did. And I was glad that I didn't have to do that, because I think it's less interesting in many ways. But I understood that we had the opportunity to read as a group, sort of, and read collectively, and as such, read for ideas, to read more generally. And so then I was able to read selfishly what it was that I was interested in. I don't have criticisms or critiques about the books. I liked them all. So I try to take bits of pieces of the books that allow me to think through what my interests are. So, like I said, my comments might be slightly different. I want to begin by sort of saying that the first go through was really sort of a personal reading, and all the books I was perhaps oddly moved by. I mean, odd because we don't talk about sort of having this affective experience in reading books, but perhaps because I've not been able to read books that I care about for a while. It was sort of this very charmed moment when I could engage with books of people who I knew, and they were really good. And I said, like, oh yeah, so it's not just me who's interested in this. But But in all the ways, they sort of capture different moments of time. And like I said, for me, it was I approached it as a personal reading. So Eva Marie's, it was sort of thinking about ancestors and how they influence us. And I think that you do a really great job of giving a dynamic that we often ignore. So for me, it was both, you know, thinking through how we often lose that dynamic in discussions around religion, because that's often what I'm concerned about. Because the way in which you're talking about the way you're talking about how the ancestors remain relevant in the decision making of people is the way religious people think about and engage with religion on a personal level, right? Also, you know, thinking about my father, who passed away a few years ago, and still influences a great deal how I think about the world, how I think about engaging. Now, I have a slightly—I mean, it's, you know, I'm not an Athens or a poet in any way, but there's still this level of engagement and relevance that we often neglect, we overlook, right? So there's that. Then when I was reading Oksana's book, it sort of took me to a particular coffee shop in graduate school when I was reading like Crater and Hudson and Abramson for the first time, and sort of trying to figure out how kinship structures and patron, you know, networks worked. And I remember at the time how fortunate it was, and you know, these were people who were dead, right? But who had given me something that would help me understand what things were at a particular moment that I could never have accessed without that. And reading through Oksana's book, I felt that this would be something that, you know, 20, 30 years from now, there's going to be someone who sits in a similar coffee shop and reads through these things and tries to understand it, because it would have really been helpful to have this book when I was trying to figure out what's going on. Because you're talking about sort of the importance of relationships and connections, and they're more complicated, and there's a whole structure that's easy to overlook. And then Julie's book, again, at a personal reading, was tied in with my own fieldwork. We were there around the same time. And I got a little worked up at the end, because I won't give it away, because you should read it. But the afterword is very personal, but it's one about sort of the struggle of how one engages with your field place. And I think most of us, the books at a, you know, they capture the moment when we did field work, what things were like at that time. We try to make broader theoretical claims as to why these things matter. But that moment that we had is gone. And Julie engages with that. And for me, there was both a, it was like a sort of a warm sadness, a longing, and maybe I'm just getting old, right? You're reflecting about where things are.
Exactly the same.
But it's pretty impressive that books can still do that, right? Mm-hmm. So that was the way in which I began reading it, like I said, through, you know, a personal narrative. But then also, more broadly, there were two ways in which I was selfish in my reading, right? There were two starting points for my own interest. One was the general category of this session of belonging. You know, within my book, I'm concerned with that. Within life in general, I'm concerned with how we make belonging. I found it interesting that the session was kinship and belonging, mm-hmm. Because for me, kinship is belonging. I don't know why there's a separation. So I was looking at sort of both the way in which it gets constructed around, you know, how these books give us a sense of belonging and how we get there. But then the second thing I was really interested in is the whole idea of what the workshop is around, the future of Central Asian studies. And I try to engage it with that in the second part. In terms of belonging, I you know, of course, I look at it in terms of questions of social navigation and knowledge and how each of the books gives, you know, fills in an image of how people, you know, give meaning to their lives, right? How they sort of do these things. Like I said, Eva Marie does it in through ancestors. They're not abstract. They're maybe temporally distant, but they're, you know, the past becomes relevant to the present and also to the future, right? It's not separated. It's and you see within that the emergence of a moral framework that is a communal project. It's dialogic. It's performative. The stories are active in the world, right? They're engaging with who we are, and you see sort of this special space that the Itens offer, where they can say things that other people can't say, right? And not only can you do this, of course, in art, but you can do it, of course, in, you know, in things like joking and gestures, where, you know, you can say things that have meanings, but that couldn't be said directly. And like I said, you have also the way in which these people are struggling with sponsorship and accountability. In Oksana's book, we see the relevance of relationships, both as they're constructed around kinship, but also as they're constructed in patron relationships, and that these things aren't static categories, right? We can construct them as such conceptually, but the way in which people live them is there's a lot of fluidity, and you see how, you know, relationships come to matter, how they're valued and operationalized, how you know, people who are close kin might use biological ties, but people who are more distant use social ties, and that those
I'm sorry, there's something I want to also be able to say here.
Those ties are significant, right? They're the part of the ways in which we make sense of who we are, and they influence how we act in relationship to the person who we have a relationship to. And she gives a good example of how, you know, in talking about a mosque in this, within the narrative, how that neither morality nor legality can resolve this, but what ends up resolving it is sort of these patron-client relationships, which I think extends elsewhere. The quote that I wanted to, that I looked for briefly was, it made me think about a piece or sort of quote by Robert Merton from his a quote he used in discussing about the prevalence of sort of the machine of politics. And he's quoting a Boston ward leader, sort of a neighborhood leader in the beginning of the 20th century. He said, there's got to be in every ward somebody that any bloke can come to, no matter what he's done, and get help. Help, you understand. None of your law and justice, but help. Right? And within the narrative that Oksana is giving about Rahim, you see he's got his flaws. And people develop relationships precisely to get help, right? To take advantage. And again, this is the way in which people begin constructing how they fit in within a community, within a society, and more conceptually. Julie is talking about sort of how people are making sense in terms of belonging. Now, at one level, it is sort of this more theoretical argument of you know, moving from an understanding of belonging to an understanding of one's belief. But even at sort of a macro level, that understanding of belief is part of how one belongs, right? So it's you know, we sort of see the way in which people are moving to construct their religious identities in Bazar Kurgan is how they're fitting, how they're seeing their own belonging, their religious transformation. We see the way in which local views engage with broader theoretical arguments, but she dissects it at a sort of
the village level, and shows, you know, how belief becomes central in both liberal and Protestant measures, and then how as there's an increase in religion that's led by people who were taught under the Soviet Union, the locals are sort of trying to make sense of what it means for them in various resources that are available around them. So all of these for me were bits and pieces of how I might be able to begin understanding what belonging means in a particular context in Central Asia. So I would use it for that. I'd pull it indiscriminately. However, looking at sort of thinking through the sort of the future of Central Asian studies, I think that that it's very difficult to make the case that people care about Central Asia. We do, but few people probably care about it. And on the face of it, it is hard to convince others. And I think that poses a real challenge for us, talking about our work outside of here. All of the works that that I read were ones that are relevant far outside the field. So that's not the argument, but. I actually think we have a unique environment for Central Asian studies that we all feel, but we don't necessarily do much about it at a project level. I think that we get along, which is no small thing. It's, especially thinking about other area studies, other disciplinary. Environments that I've been in, I think that the future actually has the ability to, holistically, to sort of model what interdisciplinarity looks like, to sort of model what I mentioned a little bit around sort of problem-based approaches to learning and understanding. Like I said, we get along. I think within Central Asian studies, perhaps there's so few of us, but we tend to read outside of our disciplines. Here we have history and anthropology, but clearly there's political science that we read. There's geography. There's all kinds of other academic disciplines that we engage with and are engaged with in everyone's work that I was reading. I think that happens less so in other spaces. Like I said, part of that probably has to do with the coming of age when we were, the coming of age of access to the region when we were starting. But I think it's a gift that we shouldn't squander, that we should capitalize on. I fit that within a broader academic environment, which is difficult, as all of us know. There's few jobs. Those jobs sort of sit both in relation to a general idea of wanting to advocate interdisciplinarity, interdisciplinary approaches to jobs. But of course, as there's fewer and fewer tenure stream jobs, and here I'll talk, I guess, mostly about the U.S. context because I'm familiar with that, departments are forced to emphasize the disciplinarity of a particular approach. You increase, as you have an increase on emphasis in science, technology, engineering, and math, there is a pressure that historians and anthropologists, have to sort of argue their case. Why should people care about these disciplines and these fields as opposed to others? I think that we can do that because I think it's, of course, important. I mean, history giving background of issues, anthropology precisely, around belonging and also around values, which is, of course, connected with that. I think that the area studies can be one space where we do that. I think that we can, push back against sort of this disciplinarity approaches to all sorts of questions, because even though the three books that I read can be heavily identified within the discipline of anthropology, I think they speak more broadly and they pull, they benefit from reading more widely in the area, in the region. How can we think about an approach to solving problems. None of us, of course, have the answers alone. So how do we sort of start sharing around particular problems, collective approaches to doing these types of things? What types of new languages can we find in interdisciplinary collaboration? This, I think, is where new ideas can emerge. I also think, as we were talking a little bit yesterday about Afghanistan's relationship to Central Asia, is that we can begin engaging with different concepts of where the boundaries lie. So often we accept the state-constructed concept of where a boundary is, but if we look socially, we see that maybe it's the mountains that matter more, or it's maybe it's more historical boundaries that were there before the Russians came into the field. We can start beginning with those things. So, I think we can be creative, and in some places we're I'm not saying this isn't without challenges. When we write with colleagues outside of our own discipline, it can be more difficult to find places to publish things, as I've experienced in a few instances. But there have been a few attempts to try and to do that. I think also getting back to the challenge of how we justify our work, that's also relevant. And we often, the first move is to talk about it in terms of policy relevance, which there can be a trap there, that we say, okay, we're going to somehow make our work policy relevant without actually knowing what that means. It sounds good, but I think there are so many people who don't know what policy relevance means, even people who work in policy. So I think that, maybe here I'll just speak for my book. I don't expect that my book is read by people who are engaged in policy. But that's okay. And probably many of the books that we've discussed here aren't going to be the first things that they'll read either. But there are a way of framing bits of the argument in ways that are more open to or more easily accessible to different audiences, sort of not Central Asians. So I think we can think of ways to begin doing that. Again, I want to sort of encourage people to see how we can captive, we can sort of gather ideas collectively and use imagination and insights into sort of the human condition, and see a number of ways in which the work that we're trying to create can be used both. If we talk about policy relevance at one level, that's fine. But there's also issues of teaching, how it advances knowledge, how it preserves moments, how it allows us to understand moral framings, and of course how we sort of see within it a process of belonging, which includes conversations with ancestors, relations with with patrons and kin, and then also coming to religion on our own terms.
Yes, so I was also given the task of reading these three books, which I thought I already knew, because I followed all of the years of them coming into being, and so I was very surprised, pleasantly surprised, when I read them as books during my summer vacation, and I learned so much. And yet I think it's still very difficult for me to talk about the ethnographic content. If you're too close to something, you know something so well. For me at least, it's very hard to speak about it. So in reading these books again, like David, I took a lot of notes for myself. But for the purpose of the comment now, I thought of a different way of engaging with all three of them. Because I think they're very interesting similarities and differences between these three books, which, and here David is right, and that's something I thought of in the morning, could have just been referred under the rubric of belonging. Yeah, I think that would have been sufficient enough. But so the two comments I want to make are sort of on a meta level. The first one is about the role of an introduction in an ethnography-based monograph. And the second one is related to the category of belonging in relation to authorship. So I'll start my comments on introductions. All of these three introductions are very different in kind, I thought. In Oksana's book, the introduction reads almost like an article in itself that summarizes and tells everything up front. So you know what you will get. You read the introduction, you know what the book will be about, what the main argument is, what the course of events is. You even know that the main protagonist of the book will die in the end. This might not make for a good storyline if this were a novel, but I found it very helpful when reading the ethnographic chapters. In general, I think Oksana did a great job emphasizing her main arguments throughout the book. And the introduction in particular shows to me that she has really mastered her material. And I had the impression you could probably wake her up in the middle of the night and she would be able to give you a concise summary of what her book is about. In Julie's book, the introduction was written a long time after her fieldwork, and it's also different from the one she had in her PhD thesis. It's quite long, it's almost exclusively theoretical, and shows the kind of thinking she has done in the time after submitting the PhD. She argues that when exploring a secular definition of religion, we need to position the secular as a concept distinct from the liberal. I suggest, she says, that what we've taken to be the modern secular definition of religion is merely its liberal secular variant, produced by states dominantly operating in this register. And Soviet modernization, in contrast, she argues, followed another course, more oriented to interpersonal affiliation and organization. So both the category of nation and religion were categories of collective belonging, Julie finds. Julie's introduction is almost free from ethnographic examples, and thus the reader is really keen to start reading the individual ethnographic chapters to see what she makes out of this quite heavy introductory text. In Eva's book, the introduction starts with a quote by one of her main informants, or collaborators, as she calls them, and the main bulk of the introduction uses ethnographic examples and her own interaction with local actors to situate the book in various themes, such as state paternalism, cultural nationalism, and what she calls the dialogic emergence of ancestry and dialogic leadership. Talking about the Kazakhstani state, she writes in her introduction, I quote, "Kazakh culture is celebrated in theory, but not always in practice," unquote. And I read her own way of approaching her topic as countering this local approach, celebrating local practice in order to make theoretical arguments. And to me, this was a very balanced introduction that seemed free-flowing and reads very well, and must have been as hard to write for Eva, I think, as Julie's must have been for you and Oksana for you. So I was just fascinated by the diversity of the way you introduce your books. And these three introductions do three very different things. Oksana summarizes her finding and she stakes her claim, I find. While Julie places her ethnographic research within debates that have been going on in the anthropology of religion that is dominated by authors whom you cannot not cite and engage with, and from which you seem to have to distance yourself if you want to make an argument at all. And Assad and Geertz, for example, are only a few of those with whom you have to deal with. So while Oksana's introduction is straightforwardly claiming a space for her as a scholar by situating herself in a mostly Central Asian context where there is still a vast step of unexplored topics, Julie's introduction has to squeeze in because she's using her Central Asian material to make space in the overcrowded house that is the anthropology of religion. I understand the necessity in doing so, but I liked her conclusion so much more because here we already know her ethnography and you're balancing these two parts so nicely there. Now, Eva's introduction to me is paradigmatic of the way she positions herself throughout her research. I would say even that some of the very definitions she has for certain of her key terms mirror the way she has portrayed herself as being in the field. And I would like to quote one of these instances on page 22. She says, quote, "Culture itself is dialogic, requiring continual collusion in social interaction. Thus, even in routinized traditions, cultural performances are emergent and therefore unpredictable. There's always both a powerful potential and the threat of complete failure." And I think this book is just so much more a powerful potential than a threat of complete failure. So I think you did a tremendously good job in writing this. So the question that comes out of this observation, which is very subjective, of course, is how did you make the decision of writing the introduction the way you did? So why did you give everything away at the beginning? Why is it so theoretical? Why is it so autobiographic? That's just something I was really interested in to know more about. The second comment is again very much a meta comment concerning belonging and authorship that I detected in all three books, again in very different ways. In Ifa's book, the way she describes that the book is co-produced with her informants and assistants. Particularly again in the introduction, she positions herself alongside her assistants, even behind them, I'd say, and while stumbling into what becomes a co-production of text, acknowledging the help she received from her assistants with transcriptions and translations, but then also with the analysis of her data, she eventually realized that, I quote, "Given my theoretical focus on performance, voice, and participant frameworks, and the inherently linguistic nature of my ethnography, after that wonderful summer's experience, during which she had several young Kazakh women come into her house every day to help analyze the data," she says, "Shouldn't this dialogic process be more firmly at the center of all my research and analysis in the future?" And this is how she came to develop dialogue as method, as she calls it. To me, this was particularly evident in how she worked with a woman she calls Saltanat. She writes, quote, "My presence as a friend and ethnographer motivated a particular general direction, such as the idea that I was interested in talking to people about Bata, for example. But ultimately, Saltanat was in charge of our further interactions." So she's positioning herself alongside or peeking over the shoulders of Saltanat, maybe. And this becomes clear when she cites segments from informal talk between Saltanat, an informant, and herself, where Saltanat appears to be the one in charge, prompting the informant by stating her opinion about Bata clearly, apparently explaining it to Eva, while at the same time getting the third person into the mode of talking at all. And I want to kind of read out this particular part, and maybe David and Julie can help me in doing so, because it's three persons interacting with one another. So David is it's page 28 if you have.
Are we
book.
Staging or you?
I was hoping we were going to do an iTunes because I kind of wanted to sing.
So, David can be Saltanat. I'm Madame Gül and Julie is... No, you're Madame Gül and I'm Eva. I'm the author, okay? Mm-hmm. So, Saltanat starts.
So you just said... Mm. Okay, sorry, I know. Then any Bata goes in parallel with the upbringing of a person.
Exactly, exactly.
It brings a person up. Education begins with the young ones. They are waiting for someone to tell them. There's a move I'm supposed to turn to the author. you see, this goes parallel.
This Bata, it is connected. It acts as the first key with education. Or you could say that education, it is the truest key. But in order for any step to advance without stepping wrongly, it won't be expressed like that. Express it. You should do it like this so that each person becomes a little more conscious, a little more understanding, is already listening. From this, it should walk with a different step.
And there are many of these instances throughout her book where Ifa is there and people talk to her, she's like really, really in the background of things. And so she's positioning herself alongside, I said. And this is the way she often appears. So there's a co-production of knowledge going on here that she has explicated, and this is important to me, not in regard to a post-colonial stance in which natives write back and have their own opinion and are as smart as the people researching them, or in which we can no longer write about others at all, but in a way that is linked to the very nature of her research topic. In her conclusion, she brings up the notion of dialogic democracy by Rosemary Kuhn, which is described as involving social systems of signification open enough to provide the cultural conditions for a wide variety of people. Dialogic democracy allows diverse groups to express identity, community, and social aspiration in the service of imagining and constructing alternative social universes. In the Aitiz tradition, Ifa says, Democracy refers fundamentally to forms of participation and voice, the desire to establish a dialogue of accountability with leaders. And I think in this sense, Eva's book is a democratic book. Now, in Oksana's book, you can see the issue of belonging and authorship not so much in the content of what she has written, but in the kind of textual documents that frame the book before she gets to her ethnographic chapters. I'm talking about the foreword and the acknowledgements that, to me, mirrored the very processes she was talking about in her book, namely the poetics of patronage she's describing. There is, in other words, an interesting overlap between the patronage system in Kyrgyz politics and the patronage system in Western academia that, to me, is particularly present in this case, but in many others as well. Being positioned in a hierarchy of more senior scholars whom you are thankful for, while having to make sure to keep a healthy distance from in order to develop your own take on things. So these people are much more present sometimes than you wish them to be, but yet you need them and they're important. To these people, on the other hand, you're also much more than a client, because it is only through you and your work that their work can be validated. As much as Eva has debated whether her ethnographic work belonged to her at all, as it was possible only through the collaboration of her local friends, in forewords and acknowledgements, authors, all of us, often credit their analysis to senior colleagues by whom we've been influenced, who've shaped our thinking, and so on. Very often, however, particularly in the cases of PhDs, a particular way of thinking or schools of thought are not to be chosen freely, but expected to be followed, even in cases when ethnographic material presents itself otherwise. Reading Oksana's book made me think that the poetics of patronage is actually a very fitting term for the academic production of knowledge. In Julie's book, the question of belonging and authorship is visible not in the beginning, as in Oksana's book, and not throughout the text, as in Eva's case, but in her conclusion. Like David, I found her conclusion very honest and very sad. And I wanted to cite from the conclusion, but I'm not doing that because I think it's probably better to...
I don't care.
It's probably better to read it yourself.
No, go ahead.
But okay, you want me to read it?
Yeah,
okay, good.
It's not a secret.
So basically she returns to Bazar Kogon in the southern part of Kyrgyzstan in 2015, and most of you know that there had been this wave of violence in 2010. And so she returns to the place and says, "My suspicions proved to be true. When I visited Bazar Kogon in 2015, 5 years after the violence, I never asked about it, but everyone brought it up. War was the word my friends used to speak about it. It took some getting used to the vocabulary, as I'd always reflected on events with the English word violence in my mind. I was jarred when friends would say, 'Oh, you know, the war.' At first, I got lost in the conversation, trying to think about which war they meant. It took several conversations to realize that that was the way the ethnic violence came to be spoken of in town. As I began to hear stories and as I saw pictures of the events, I realized why. In addition to the violence perpetrated by civilians, there have been all manner of military vehicles and weaponry in town. For residents, it must have felt like a war. I could see and hear the trauma in my friends' words, eyes, dispositions, and stories. No research could simply follow up and see how things had developed without considering the enormity of what had changed and without facing the trauma that had marked the town. It was a task I was unwilling to take. My research ended when I left, and what is here is the situated knowledge of religious life in a small Kyrgyz Uzbek town produced from that period of fieldwork in 2003 and 2004. So I thought that was very powerful. It was also very honest. And I think here, again, speaking of belonging and authorship, I think we see that the stories we can tell and the analysis we're able to make are always entwined with what people are able and willing to say. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a sad ending for this panel, but I really enjoyed reading the three books of these.